tsunami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 437 of the Tsunami Escape podcast. I'm C. Kohler, and with me tonight is Crocodile.
Hello.
Seda can't be here tonight. He's covering news from Gamescom. So it's just going to be me and Crocodile tonight. And let's go right into the news. I've got a few items here. The bigger ones to me were some announcements coming out of the upcoming New York Comic Con. I think these are in October. So the two things, one is that Primal Season 3 will be shown at Comic Con. It's going to be like the premiere of that. And it is scheduled to appear on Adult Swim in early 2026. And another premiere that is more closely tied to Toonami is that they're going to premiere the dub of the first episode of Rooster Fighter.
Well, I'm looking forward to both. I'm still surprised Primal is getting another season. Like, obviously, there was room to continue, which they're doing with supposed to be about Spear's daughter. I felt like season two was putting aside the controversy of the ending itself. I thought it was kind of like, if this was the final season of Primal Forever, this would be fine. Though, kind of surprised during season three, but I'm going to keep open mind. It'd still be a good time.
Yeah, I agree. I felt like the last season was pretty much a closing chapter for that story, but guess not. I mean, it probably was just so popular that they decided to make more.
I think we can assume that it's going to be like before, where premieres outside of Toonami and then like the reruns show up in Toonami. I assume that's probably the working assumption, right?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, I think a lot of that happened back when we were really starving for acquisitions. So it's possible still, but I don't know if it's as likely as it used to be. But you never know. The other news piece I have here is that they did premiere this weekend the promo, which was an actually pretty long promo, for the Blue Exorcist Shimane Illuminati saga. And a lot of people in our thread who were watching along really took quite notice of the fact that the show does look quite a bit different, and that is not too surprising considering that I've learned that while the first two seasons were done by A1 Studios, this new one is done by Studio Voln, which is a completely different studio.
Yeah, I'm curious how much staff they share, if any, because obviously animators move between studios. They're not necessarily locked in any one place. But even just as a glance, as you kind of alluding to and mentioning, the show does look, I mean, it's clearly Blue Exorcist. The show also looks very much different, and it'll be unclear if that's a better different or worse different until we actually see this episode in full. It's definitely different.
Yeah, a lot of people in the comments during our group watch were saying like, wow, they really increased the budget. And I didn't pick up on that. I thought it looked different, but I didn't know if it looked better. Somebody commented that it's now the art style is more closer to what the manga looks like, which may be true. But I don't know. It looked all right. And I don't know if it looked amazing to me. Maybe I didn't see something they saw, but it looked good.
Yeah, closer to manga can be a double-edged sword because it depends on what the source material looks like. Definitely some anime that have deviated from the manga for the better and some for the worse. Like, obviously, when you're doing animation, there's some amount of simplification that typically has to go on just for the sake of animation. But even then, I think there are a good number of animes that look better than their manga counterparts, art-style-wise. And of course, there's some that look worse, putting aside the often simplification as, again, go into animating anything. But yeah, it's just a matter of we'll see if it's better or worse.
Yeah, and I don't remember what they do kind of lay out the plot of the season. I will admit I don't quite remember what it was, other than I do remember it feeling like it was very much progressing the story, the overall story of the series in a pretty big way.
I think the highlights were that Lucifer is showing up in that whole golden mask, and he's trying to resurrect Satan. Like, Lucifer and Satan are different entities in this narrative. Like, you see in some narratives, Lucifer and Satan are synonymous, and sometimes there are different people. Like, for example, Shin Megami Tensei treats Lucifer and Satan as different entities. I'm sure you're familiar with that. I think it's in Persona as well. So it depends on narrative. Mm-hmm. it seems to be in one of those where Lucifer and Signor are different people. So Lucifer's showing up, he's wearing a golden mask, and we're going to revive Satan for some reason or another, because, you know, demonic cults always want to revive Satan. And obviously, there's some kind of like, maybe a tree amongst us.
Mystery. Oh, yeah. And then there's
suspense.
There's something about Izumi getting possessed by like a fox demon that was in there too.
Yeah, I remember. So I have no idea how that one's going to turn out, but it could be interesting. But, you know.
So you're like me, you haven't seen this, right?
I've not. The only Blue Exorcist I've seen was the first season like 10 years ago. So that was obviously kind of a rewatch when I was looking at the most recent airing. But the season we just had was totally new to me. And then all future seasons would also be new to me. So, I'm Blue Exorcist. I wouldn't say virgin, but I feel that's a much better way of saying that. Neophyte. There you go. Neophyte. That's a better way of saying
Neophyte.
That.
Neophyte. What so, do you know? Like, I know there's this upcoming season, which is like the third season. How many more are there? Is there just a fourth season, or is there a fourth and a fifth season?
I think there's a fourth and a fifth as well. I think the fourth and fifth one are more recent, and I think they're 12 episodes each. But don't quote me on that. It's might something you might want to look up on Wikipedia or something. But my understanding is that there are 5 seasons.
Wow, okay, that's a lot more than I thought. So I feel like Toonami's kind of in the long haul for Blue Exorcist going forward here, because they've got a lot of content here they can use. And it's interesting.
I could well into next year, so this is basically the best case scenario when Blue Exorcist came back to block at all. I think this was the best case scenario we all hoped for. Like, if they're going to get Blue Exorcist, if they're going to re-show the first season from 10 years ago, hopefully it's just an excuse to kind of lay the groundwork for showing future seasons, as opposed to just being so desperate you have to re-air stuff from 10 years ago. That would be like the worst case scenario. Thankfully, we're in the best case scenario for this. So
I just hope that they keep a half hour somewhere where they can continue to bring in some shows that we would like to see come back that they didn't complete. Not that I have anything against Blue Exorcist. I don't. And I mean, obviously Bleach is great. I don't want Bleach to leave either, but like, I'd love to see a Dr. Stone. I'd love to see a couple of other shows show up. So I don't know if that'll ever happen, considering they're kind of playing the long game here with two big running shows, Bleach and Blue Exorcist. So
right,
I
guess there's some complications that I don't entirely understand with potentially, at least with future Dr. Stone seasons and future Fire Force seasons. But if they were to come back, I assume they'd be near the front of the block, and that's pretty full, at least for time being. It's gonna be gone soon enough. Let's see what else. Bleach is gonna be around for a while. Deluxe is always gonna be around for a while. I'm actually curious with Dan the Dan if we're actually gonna go straight into season 2, or if we just have season 1 lined up. We'll find out eventually.
I don't know either, but my feeling right now is that we wouldn't go directly into season 2 just because it's so new, because it's like literally airing right now. So I feel like they're probably gonna be a break. There.
I mean, season 2 should end before season 1 ends on Toonami, I believe. But even then, it'll just be like, it'll ended only a few weeks ago, if it shows on Toonami, so.
Yeah, and I don't think it's like a reason. I'm thinking more like, not so much that they couldn't air it, but more like they just can't afford it right away. Like, they have to wait like a year or something for the licensing to become more, I mean, I don't know that, but that's just that's my feeling right now, because I just feel like Dandadan is such a huge property right now that I'd just be surprised if they go right into season 2. I would like that, but see, I guess. I mean,
I think in the old days you would have been more confident of that, because like when Toonami was airing the newest hotness from Japan in the old days, it was often like a few weeks after the Japanese, or like maybe a few months. Like, so like a quick turnaround wouldn't be unprecedented for the old days. But we're also in a new era. Like, clearly things are looking up, but like things are obviously different as well, so it's a little hard to gauge. I'm just hoping to extend to the second season, because A, the second season has been very good. B, the first season ends on a horrible, horrible cliffhanger. So
okay.
Let's just hope we don't do that.
Again, I've said this before, like, I don't think Toonami has to have the latest shows to be successful. I think it just has to have really good shows. So if we had to wait a year for the second season of Dandadan, that's fine to me, as long as we continue to get good shows in the interim. But if they do go directly into that, but if they did go directly into the second season of Dandadan, that would be like a big deal to me, because it'd be like, wow, they really can just do that.
Yes, that would be quite awesome and again bode well for current state of the block. I'll just see how you feel about that waiting a year if they do end up with season one after you see the cliffhanger, but you know,
that's okay. Well, I mean, I see, I know you're kind of joking, but like the funny thing is that like I didn't watch Dawn to Dawn when it aired before. And it's like, yeah, if I was on a cliffhanger, it's like, sure, nothing. I could just go watch it. But I don't know. I just think it's more like, I'm just thinking more from the Toonami's perspective. But it'll be funny. Like if the, I'll tell you this, though. If they don't go directly into season two of Dawn to Dawn, I won't watch it. I'll wait for it to air on Toonami because I waited for the first season. So
at least it's not like Mashle seasons one and two where we're still waiting on season two. But at least season one ended well enough, or so like if you didn't watch any more of it, like we're just in the middle of something, but you know, again, we'll get to that.
That's Mashle. I like Mashle, but Mashle is like the story of Mashle is not as compelling as Dawn to Dawn.
Oh, of course not. But I'm just saying there's a difference between seasons ending in self-contained fashions and then one ending literally in the middle of like an arc in a, like kind of like, oh, for fuck's sake, kind of way. But again, we'll get there.
Okay. All right. That's all I had for the news.
Yep, I've got nothing else to add. So,
okay. So let's go ahead and go into the first show of the block, which of course is Daima. Dragon Ball Daima, Episode 9, Thieves. I'll give the quick rundown like we have been doing. So we'll start out with, there's some, the group want, they're back in the plane and they really, really, really want to stop and get a hotel somewhere, but they can't risk it because of Goku's hair. He's too recognizable, so they put this goofy hat on him to disguise his hair, and they fly down to a hotel and, get a nice room and take some baths. Of course, Goku keeps taking his hat off though, because it's itchy and he gets spotted immediately by some ruffians. Then, they go back, they hear ruckus downstairs. They kind of, you know, everyone's taking their baths or whatever. They go back downstairs, they hear ruckus and there's like this werewolf guy down there causing a big, you know, scene. But this all turns out to be a diversion because the other guys that were with him snuck into the room and stole the Dragon Ball. And now Goku has to go and find these guys, fight them, and get it back, which he does. And before we get to the commercial break, it's decided that Goku will stay up and watch the Dragon Ball all night long while everyone else sleeps. And we get kind of a funny little scene where he almost does it, but eventually does fall asleep. But luckily, the Dragon Ball is not stolen again. And we do cut over quickly to see that Bulma's team has gone through the same, basically the same pattern of events that the original team did when they first arrived. They went to a bar, got into a fight. The bad guys then stole their plane. So now Bulma's team has their plane stolen. Okay, commercial break. When we come back, We're still with the Bulma's team, which is Bulma, Vegeta, and Piccolo. And we see a flashback to what had happened. Vegeta beats up those punks at a bar. It was more like a dance club kind of place anyway. And they're complaining about that they've lost their plane. And then I think Bulma notices that Hybus, for some reason, has a weird eyeball on his buckle that keeps looking around. And Hybus is just like, oh, yeah, I found this somewhere and I thought it was cool. Which I'm sure is important, but that's pretty much all we get. Meanwhile, we do get a cut over to a scene of Goma and his guy, Degasu, I think.
Yes, that's the name.
And I keep thinking, what's the guy, just if you real quick, briefly here, Degasu is Goma's Glind like companion. What is the name of the guy that was always with the Supreme Kai?
Kabito. I mean, the pink hair guy? I mean, pink hair,
Kabito.
Pink skin guy? With the white hair, tall guy? Yeah.
Yeah.
Kabito.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so I'm getting them, like, their names mixed up. For some reason, I have them backwards. So, Degasu is the new character. Okay. Anyway, Goma's sitting in his, like, I don't know, office or whatever, and Degasu is telling him about how the Earthlings have showed up. They're here in the demon world. They've already got a Dragon Ball. Goma goes, he yells. He's upset. He's mad at Degasu because all this stuff is happening. And it gets really kind of cartoony and like Looney Tunes-esque in the way that they portray Goma in this scene. It's kind of funny.
It's very strong with 70 Sam energy, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, like his head gets like giant and stuff, and it's like really funny looking. So anyway, Goma's caught up to date now about the fact that the Earthlings are here. Meanwhile, it turns out everyone's getting reunited. So the Goku team and the Bulma team have met up now. And, you know, they kind of let them know that, oh, yeah, our plane was stolen. And then but Goku's like, well, you know, we can't fit any more people in our plane, so you'll just have to wait here. And then they take off and leaves the others just hanging around. And then the last point of the episode is that those stooges who stole Bulma's plane, I guess I should say Hybus's plane. Yeah. Those guys are like hiding nearby. Vegeta senses them, decides to fight them along with Piccolo, and Hybus and Bulma just sort of watch. And Hybus particularly just eats a lot of potato chips or something. And and then they beat up the guys and they're like, give us our plane back. And he's like, yeah, it's over there. It's over there. So I think they have their plane back now. And then, although I don't think they showed that. And then the very final end of this episode is probably the most important, which is we cut back to the woman, what's her name?
Oh, her name, I don't remember off the top of my head. Saved two people.
Yeah. Dr. Arinsu, that's it. So anyway, we go back to them and they have completed creating the new Majin. It wakes up, it looks pretty cool, and it's called, instead of being called Majin Buu, it's called Majin Kuu. And it talks and she's like, go get a Dragon Ball. And he's like, I will, or something like that.
I think it was mission accepted or something of that sort, but it's the same gist.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, it's like mission accepted or something. So this one isn't as... this one's a little more compliant. And that's the episode.
No, they made a big deal in terms of when they're making this Majin, and it kind of touched upon that last episode, how Majin Buu was too strong, so like uncontrollable, so they kind of fucked it up. So like they dialed things back on this Majin, so... clearly, this Majin is nowhere near as powerful as Majin Buu, but he's also way more controllable. And you can see just from his, as soon as he speaks, it's like his vibe and his mannerisms and his intellect is totally different from Majin Buu's.
Yeah. They put a little bit of Majin Buu in there. They put some kind of little seed in there, which I thought was kind of neat because, I mean, I guess it's kind of also like the Glins, how they grow. They grow like plants, kind of.
Seed? Oh, because, I know there's like, you know, a little back and forth, but do you want to say anything? Because I certainly have things to say, but I don't want to jump on you. So if you know things you wanted to say first before I start talking.
No, you can go.
Okay. So one thing I want to mention is that you notice that little seed. Actually, you remember the Cybermen back from the Saiyan saga?
Kinda, yeah.
Remember what?
I know they grew them.
Yeah, that Nappa was growing, that they fought off. They killed Yamcha, and of course, there's a classic Yamcha pose scene. And then, Krillin killed the rest of them. This is the seed they used here was a Cyberman seed. They actually mentioned the Mabel, I think is her name, and the chunkier, more older sorceress. She mentioned she used to sell these seeds to Outworlders, and she only has a few of them left, and they used one of these Cyberman seeds as a base for Majin Kuu, which is why he looks like a Cyberman, but there's also a mini lore dump for like she, or at least the Majin from the demon world or the source of the Cybermen that the Saiyans used back in like 20 years ago, I guess.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that the Saiyans used, I forgot that. That's interesting.
Yeah. So I don't know if Mabel or whatever her name is actually ever interacted directly from Nappa, but it's clear that there's like from her or from Majin like her, eventually Saiyan seeds made outside the demon realm and into universe 7 and eventually into the hands of the Saiyans. So there was that link.
Well, I guess, I mean, it could be something related to the Namekians, you know what I mean?
Well, no, like,
because the Namekians had left the demon world, demon realm, and come to our universe. So
no, but she was mentioning specifically that she sold Cybermen seeds to Outworlders.
Okay, well, fine. Yeah, okay. Marba then, yeah, maybe she had sold them to the Namekians of the past, or not the Namekians, excuse me, the Saiyans of the past.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay, yeah, you were mentioning the Namekians, and I was like, I don't think they have anything to do with this, but rather, yeah.
Well, I did say that initially, and I meant that. What I meant was, I thought, I wonder if the Namekians had them, but you're right. She said she specifically sold them to Outworlders, right, which now makes me think Marba probably left the Demon Realm and sold them to Saiyans and other people.
Right. So, there's no direct indication that she ever interacted with Nappa specifically, but she may have interacted with Saiyans, and then they passed them down to Nappa through whatever way.
Right.
Yeah. That, yeah, okay. But yeah, so that was a little random Cybermen lore that just Toriyama decided to throw in there, or I guess for shits and giggles. But yeah, it's apparently Cybermen come from the Demon Realm.
A lot comes from the Demon Realm, is what we're learning.
Yeah, apparently, which I'm sure Toriyama just decided maybe a year before he unfortunately passed away. But it's his story, so he can do whatever the fuck he wants. But
I like it. I like having these kind of answers. I think it's cool.
It makes things certainly more interconnected. Like, obviously, there wasn't any well-established Cybermen lore beforehand, so it's there's nothing to retcon. Just he increased the lore, he added lore rather than changing in some willy-nilly way here. So yeah, this is just an addition. So
yeah, I mean, I said, I like the whole idea that the Namekians were originally Majin. You know, I think that's neat that they came from the Demon Realm. It's kind of cool.
I think it also gives new meaning to Demon King Piccolo, which is, of course, the title of Piccolo's ancestor. You know, the original Piccolo from the Dragon Ball. So that's kind of gives some playing to that and whatnot. Yeah. And I think there are other instances in which kind of may have been mentioned or alluded to about the Namekians, Demon World's links. But this, obviously, Daima's the first time it's made, okay, this is set in stone and certainly, locked in, so to speak. Yeah. Otherwise, excuse me. I'll mention I was kind of impressed how on the ball is the right way to say it, but the thieves were extremely competent in terms of setting up the plan, executing it, basically succeeding. And then, of course, Goku's team, or maybe Pan's more specifically, was extremely competent in setting basically a trap for if anyone were to take the Dragon Ball, she could locate them and whatnot. Kind of dragon radar and kind of bugging. I think she it was just a dragon radar, or did she also bug the Dragon Ball? I feel like she did both, but I remember it was a little hazy. But she basically had a backup plan, and so it's kind of just the villains were being kind of competent, the heroes being very competent, and made for an encounter that was that only lasted for a first bit of the episode. In a worse paced version of this show, if this was as if the total theft would have lasted maybe two episodes or whatnot. Instead, it lasts maybe 5-10 minutes. But I think it just with everyone actually being relatively competent, and I think just everything's better for it. So that's kind of noticing how things are done here versus how they may have been done worse in the past. I like the little Glorio finish him off his little electro whip. That was kind of a fun little antidote. Of course, Goku can't wait till the hotel room to take off his damn hat. So, of course, it's necessary for the plot to move forward, but it's come on, Goku, wait 5 minutes. But that's just Goku for you.
Yeah, this is what I was talking about last episode, about the fact that, I know that Goku is an adult in a child's body, but he still just, he acts like a child. He's indistinguishable from a child. I mean, fault.
I would say still that actual child Goku and this current Goku are pretty distinct, but I think even adult Goku are always had those childish elements to him. So, this is just kind of manifesting in one of those unfortunate ways.
So my thoughts on the episode were that it was pretty good. I agree completely. My main point was the pacing. It's good. I actually felt like this episode went kind of really fast. And I don't think in a bad way, but it was just kind of there wasn't a lot of downtime in this episode. Things were happening quickly, and I like that we did get to finally see a little bit of the other team, even if it was just a brief thing. I mean, they just need to get together and stop being separate. It's kind of I know that's going to happen eventually. It's kind of frustrating that we have to keep these groups separate right now. Unless I wouldn't mind it as much if the Bulma, Piccolo, Vegeta team were doing something interesting, but they just seem like they're just lagging behind. They need to, if they're going to have them split up, they should both be doing something interesting, and the other team is just not. So I want them to just get together and then have everyone around so they can bounce off each other, like they did it briefly in this episode. We just haven't seen enough of that team. But aside from that, yeah, things move pretty quickly. I like the fact that we've already got the new Majin. I wasn't expecting that to happen this quickly. So again, I think the pacing is pretty quick here. And overall, pretty good episode.
The only thing I mentioned lastly is that you also kind of noticed that the eyeball that's on Ahimus's belt, its purpose, they actually, Goma, you're paying attention to what Goma Degasu were talking about. You could pretty clearly link between what they were saying and what was going on with on this team and Hybus's belt. I don't know how much I should stress what is in play here. I don't, maybe that might be spoilers, but like if there was, the two scenes were juxtaposed next to each other for a reason. I'll just say that without trying to delve into spoilers. And so let's just say,
I assume somebody was looking through that, and I kind of thought it was Dr. Arensu, but now that you're mentioning it, it could just as easily be the other group of bad guys. So somebody bad is watching them, no doubt. I assume that much, because it's like, why introduce this otherwise, you know?
That's, I'll come play in later, but yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to Dandadan. Dandadan episode 4, Kicking Turbo Granny's Ass. And this episode, real quick before I go through the rundown, is, you know, the last episode, Daima was pretty fast. This episode is like five times faster than that. Like a lot happens in this episode in the very short amount of time.
We got some quick characters, so it makes sense.
Yeah, and I mean, it fits for the theme of the speed of the episode. But yeah, there's a lot that happens. So I'm going to try to run through this real quickly here. So Turbo Granny's giant head, they're in the tunnel. The Turbo Granny's giant heads block them in. And then this is very paraphrasing here. We can fill it in later. But Okarun's banana is returned to him. But Momo's pretty cool. She sticks to her guns. She challenges Turbo Granny. She knows Turbo Granny can't resist a challenge. And so she challenges him. But she says she needs a head start. And she says, you know, give me like 60 seconds or something like that. Or 6 minutes or something like that. And it's like, yeah. And then Turbo Granny cheats, quote unquote, cheats by just counting minutes instead of seconds. You know, so she's basically won without them having even getting out of the tunnel. But then Okarun does something I couldn't have seen happening in a million years. He just goes out and he just bites her boob. I'm just going to let you sit with that.
I think it's related to the Turbo Granny mythology. So like there's a reason besides just kitty biting. Like I'm pretty sure that the mythological reason for that, like I think you bite Turbo Granny's tits, like they weakens her. Like I think that's part of the mythology of Turbo Granny.
Okay. Yeah, it comes out of left field for me. I mean, okay. And she did talk about that too, but, and they kind of give her a hard time about it. And he's like, you told me to do this. But anyway, it does kind of distract her for a moment. And then Momo is like kind of over the course of this like hectic, I mean, I can't do it justice. It would take me 22 minutes to explain everything that happens in this episode. So I'm keeping it brief here. Basically, Momo ends up trapping Turbo Granny. She kind of figures out how to grab her.
Basically using the lessons from the lesson she got from her grandmother last episode from Seiko. How she visualizes aura and how she can like hold it and mold it with her hands and whatnot. So she uses that to like both kind of basically give her Turbo Granny like squeezing her heart. Like force choke and then also kind of hold on to her in other parts of the episode, but that's basically what she's doing.
Yeah, and she kind of does it in a way where like it Turbo Granny kind of gets back inside Okarun, but then Momo can grab her there and kind of prevent her from taking him over and so forth. So Okarun kind of gets the power, but he doesn't get taken over. It's interesting. Anyway, but before they actually get a chance to defeat Turbo Granny, the other spirit that Turbo Granny was working with or colluding with or whatever appears, and it is none other than our friend, the giant enemy crab. It's like a creepy crab that has like faces on it. It's just, yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, Seiko mentioned a previous episode how like Turtle Granny had kind of fused a bunch of the spirits as well. And like Turtle Granny was like the head spirit, but this is a combination of those other few spirits that basically were Turtle Granny's beck and call. I'm also, I feel pretty sure this is probably also Devilman reference, but given how influential Devilman is to so much anime and manga, that's maybe just saying like, oh, that's a JoJo reference, or oh, that's Dragon Ball reference, or like all over the place. But this feels like pretty distinct Devilman call. Are you familiar with Devilman at all? You know what creature?
No, not really.
Fair enough, no. But I'm pretty sure it's a Devilman reference, and I'll leave it at that. People will know, will know.
Well, anyway, Okarun is able to use Turbo Granny's true form and use her power in order to run. And he starts running and gets chased by this crab thing. And they make it kind of out of the, and they're on their way. This ultimately ends up, again, a lot happens here. I mean, they're all over the city. Crazy stuff happens. But basically, they end up getting into like this hot spring area where they boil the crab alive. When they think finally they've defeated the crab thing, they suddenly are getting chased by cemetery spirits that I think Turbo Granny has summoned them. I think,
yeah, because they're still in Turbo Granny's domain, so she kind of has ability to like call spirits in her domain to come aid her. I think it looked like she was using like the telephones to do that or something, but yeah, since they're basically in Turbo Granny's domain, she can like just do shit basically,
yeah. She can summon them. So kind of they start coming at them like zombies, basically. They've taken over people or whatever. But yeah, they start coming. After the commercial break, we come back and Momo's like, we just got to run. And then, you know, Okarun's like, I'm out of power. I can't do it. And she's like, do it. We can do this. I know how to do this. And then we get this really great sequence set to a techno version, a techno remix of the William Tell Overture. And super awesome animation. They're just running. Turbo Granny's chasing them. But then Okarun's power, he runs out of power. However, Momo has a great idea. She lures Turbo Granny closer, and then she grabs onto a bullet train, knowing that the Turbo Granny can only run so fast, and the bullet train is faster. However, and it's leading them towards where Seiko is, I guess where the boundary is of the Turbo Granny's domain. However, Turbo Granny does mention that sometimes the trains don't always go quite as fast as their top speed. So she does kind of get up on them. But ultimately, Turbo Granny gets defeated. And we kind of see that the souls of the young girls who had died that are part of the Turbo Granny legend, I think, are released. Their souls are released. And then the final scene of the episode, which was really fun, is we just sort of get like a cool down where everyone's back at the temple where Seiko lives. And I guess, does Momo live there with her grandma?
Yes.
Okay. I wasn't sure about that. Okay. Yeah. So they're back at their house. You know, Seiko is giving Okarun a hard time about, hey, is your banana return? Show me. And he's like, I'm not going to show you. And they start running around. And then we see Momo being really weird how she eats. Like they're all hungry for crab now. And she's like eating the crab. And
very iconic Momo face. She has a lot of these.
Yeah, it's like a really goofy, like, she looks like a chipmunk or something, the way she's eating that. It was really goofy. I'm not even sure what that's supposed to be. Is that just her hungry, or is she, like, trying to avoid the situation, or what?
No, she's munching the crab meat, like, she's like, you know what someone's...
Right, but like, the way she's doing it made me think, like, is she just eating it funny, or is she, like... trying to make a distraction because she doesn't want to pay attention to
it. She's eating it funny because she's a funny ass girl. Like,
okay.
I thought that was the case. Yeah. You see how crazy her grandmother is? Like, you know, apples don't fall that far from the tree. They're a bunch of weirdos.
Yeah. It was great though. It was funny. And anyway, but the final moment of the episode though, which was really nice, is after all the hijinks, Okarun is like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to go home now. And, you know, and Momo's like, okay, well, all right. And she says, like, goodbye. And then there's, like, this long bit where they're inner monologuing to each other. And they're like, well, is this goodbye or is this just goodbye? Like, does this mean, like, goodbye forever or is it just a brief goodbye? And they're really worried about it. And then Momo finally kind of, like, at the last moment, she's like, see you tomorrow. And it's like, oh, okay. So they are going to be friends. All right. And that's pretty much the episode. And I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, this is an absolutely fantastic episode. This is getting nominated for Fight of the Year because it's very creative in, like, battle. Like, it wasn't just, like, fisticuffs. Oh, yeah. It was just, like, extremely creative use of their powers. Like, both Okarun and Momo both use their power sets in very, very creative combination for a pretty incredible effect. And it's not the first. You'll see a lot of this in Dandadan. I think it's what makes some of the fights, quote unquote, better than a lot of other series, that there are kind of team ups and they're kind of like people are using powers in creative ways rather than just like beams and shit like that. You see, Momo's power is basically like ghost hands. Like I kind of mentioned before, she's kind of like the visible woman in her power set. Yeah. But she's not just like holding things, she's grabbing things, she's like making wings. She's like, you know, it's a very like, and this, she's basically still a new fight of this. She's making her psychic powers just manifest in extremely creative ways pretty early. And even Okarun's power set of super speed, I should mention briefly, like the reason that Okarun temporarily received his dong back or his pecker, or like I kind of appreciate how they keep mixing it up. They don't just stick with banana all the time, but they kind of mix up the metaphor and whatnot. The reason he got it back is because Turbo Granny gave it back to him because she noticed that he was using her power against her. So she was trying to cut that off. But of course that ended up failing because then Momo kind of trapped and whatnot. But basically each of them has their own kind of set of powers. You know, the Okarun's speedster. Momo's basically the invisible woman and whatnot, but it's just, they're using their powers in extremely creative ways that makes for extremely entertaining fight. And it's also like a lot of gamesmanship here because they don't really overpower Turbo Granny. They basically trick her. Basically, as you mentioned near the end of the episode, they got her on a train. And obviously, they can't necessarily outrun Turbo Granny because, like, trains, like Turbo Granny mentions, trains don't go full speed all the time because they have to turn. You can't take turns at full speed. But, like, they weren't really running away from Turbo Granny so much as leading Turbo Granny to the boundary. So, like, it was all like everyone's kind of like mind gaming each other. Turbo Granny trying to outsmart them, them trying to outsmart Turbo Granny. And I think, of course, that just makes for very enjoyable battles. Like, I mean, we all love Dragon Ball Z, but oftentimes just like, my laser is bigger than your laser, or more, my punch hits harder than your punch. This is very much not what happened here, and this is not what you see in other Dandadan fights. They're just very kind of creative interplay of like mystical, magical, psychic, whatever you want, powers. And so just, I thought the episode was incredible the first time I saw it. I just thought it was really great here as well. And I think also the ending, I think, is very important, just kind of whole wrap it up. Well, I say wrap it up, but like, obviously, there's a lot more of a show left. This isn't all wrapped up. And I don't think it's even spoiled to say the battle against Turbo Granny is not actually finished, but we'll find out how that plays out shortly. But like, just the manner kind of like, some people notice about Dandadan is that after each arc or after most of the arcs, there's kind of like family get together and family meal. Kind of a big theme of the show is kind of like found family. And I think it's just kind of one good example of it being manifest here.
It's like the first. Kind of like,
yeah, I guess it'd be the first big example, but keep coming up that like a bunch of weirdos kind of getting together and just kind of becoming friends and family in kind of unexpected ways, but kind of just like ends up just being really wholesome and warm and heartfelt. And even at the end there, like I think everything's wrapped up. So like you could imagine then, okay, we'll go our separate ways, even though we go to the same school. Like I said, it'd be a little awkward, but we could tend to like stop talking to each other. But this is at the end of very affirmation, like, no, this is for the long haul. They are going to be together. I don't then say forever, but like it's just a long haul thing. And so I think that kind of concern they had, especially I think Okarun was more concerned about it, at least it seemed to me, that concern he had, that was like, all right, this going to, we beat Turbo Granny. Is this it? Is this over? I think that's a very valid and relatable fear he has. And in fact, Momo was able to be like, no, man, we're tight. We're cool. We're fan. We're, you know, give it the old Fast and Furious, you know, familia bit. Like, I thought that was, she didn't do much, but what she did was very powerful. And Okarun's concerns and fears were extremely relatable. And it was just a gigantic burden off himself to have that, you know, that concern basically wiped away. And so, just from an action, the fight, the actual bit of character development between the main characters, the interactions, it's running on all cylinders.
Yeah. I mean, like I said at the beginning, there's a lot happens in this episode. This is a jam-packed episode. Of course, it doesn't drop for a moment quality wise. There never feels like there's, they use every moment of this episode to make it entertaining. And it's the best episode of this series I've seen so far. I was thoroughly impressed by it. I loved it all. And it felt climactic. While at the same time, I know this is just the beginning. So it's just great. The characters are great. I don't have anything negative to say at all about this. It's just really good. I'm more impressed with this show than I thought I would be. And that's about as high a praise as I can give it. So great episode. Looking forward to seeing what happens next. Like I said last week, I just don't know what to expect. And I like that. It's not predictable. I mean, I do know some things that happen in the future just from like osmosis that I couldn't avoid. Mostly just like, well, just like characters or something that show up later or whatever. But like, as far as the narrative and what is happening and what the goals are, I have no idea. And I'm excited to learn more. And that's all I'll say. Great show. All right, let's move on to Bleach. Bleach episode 12, Everything But the Rain, June Truth. So if you're confused, last week's episode was called Everything But the Rain. This one's called Everything But the Rain, quote, June Truth, unquote. You gotta love these episode titles, man. They're just bizarre. All right, quick rundown. Luckily, I'll tell you, when I was taking notes for Dandadan, I was like, man, I'm just taking too many notes. There's too much stuff. This one's pretty easy. I've only got six things to say, so I'll just say them quickly. So we see Captain Shiba doesn't mention Misaki in his report back to the heads back in the Soul Society. My note here says she runs into Kisuke. Who am I talking about there?
I think you mean, you know, the guy of the hobo looking guy of the funny.
Oh, hat, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Scientist guy, that Kisuke Urahara.
Yes. Misaki runs into Kisuke. Okay. Yes. Yeah. They kind of bump into each other. And he kind of notices there's something a little odd about her, but we get that in a minute. Anyway, Misaki goes back to her house. She gets in trouble and then she starts to faint and realizes she now has a hollow hole in her chest. Ryuken and Ishin meet up. They argue. But then Kisuke shows up and breaks them up and says, hey, if you want to save this girl, listen to what I have to say. Commercial break. We come back. Kisuke explains what holification is. Ishin must become, and he says that the only way you can save her, this girl, is that you must become a human soul reaper hybrid by merging your something with this thing called a Gigai, which is like a template, like a body.
Yeah, this is a concept from like very early Bleach about fake bodies that souls can reside into to get physical manifestations.
Yeah, I kind of remember, I think, Seda mentioning this a while back about the fact that, like, for them to live in the human world, they have to actually get into a fake body. And that's what this is. One of my notes here, maybe you can explain this. Katagiri wants Ryuken to not be sad. This is the maid woman, the servant.
Yes.
Katagiri, and she, I don't know if she like has feelings for Ryuken like on a romantic level, but in the very least she cares deeply about him.
I mean, she's Uryu's mother, if that gives you any hint
about well, that answers that completely. Yes, absolutely, yeah. Okay, so anyway, this is their relationship. I mean, they obviously have had a relationship for a while, but it's never been like close, and now she's kind of revealing how much she cares about him. Don't be sad, you know, he feels like everything's ruined now that that Misaki is no longer going to be a Quincy or whatever, or be with them. But no, she's like, I did this for you. I did this for the bloodline. It was revealed too that she was the one who let the
secret out. She ratted out Misaki to Yurikun's mother because it was clear that Misaki wasn't entirely well after her fight, but it wasn't really clear what was the issue until her qualifying right then and there. Basically, Ryuken had asked Katagiri because Misaki went out to go fight. Ryuken and Katagiri followed her. They saw what happened, and Ryukin told Kagure, say nothing. And she was like, okay. And then she's tattled. And then
she did anyway, because it was all for the bloodline. She was just like, we can't risk it. Anyway, my last notes here for this episode is that we do then get kind of like a long sort of sequence where we see the relationship of Masaki and Isshin as they fall in love and, get together and everything like that. And then the last thing that happens in the episode is that we see Masaki has had her power stolen by Yuhi Baha, or however you say his stupid name. Her powers have been stolen.
By the Ashveld. It's a specific event. Basically explained that Yuhi Baha is the king of all Quincy's. And basically all living Quincy's power runs through him in some manner.
Yes.
So he has the ability to both give powers to Quincy's, but also take powers back from Quincy's. And so what happened is that when Masaki was fighting Grand Fisher, she was about to clean his clock, but then Yubara did an Ausfeld and stole all powers of the what he considered impure Quincy's. And then she lost her powers, which is a pretty shitty thing to happen in the middle of a fight with a powerful hollow. And of also Katagiri, who was his frail body, whatnot, also lost her powers at the same time. And having her powers taken in her state of a body killed her, whereas Masaki was healthier, but she was also in the middle of a fight, and then she lost that fight when she wouldn't have lost it if her power was not taken.
Yeah. And so it's interesting how they do this in this episode too, because his dad is telling Ichigo this, and he's like, I've told you everything except for the real reason why your mother has died. And then you get the credits. And then we come back from the credits and he just tells them like right away. He's like, oh yeah, she had her power stolen. And we get the whole sequence. It's like they were setting up for like what the next episode was going to be. And then they just tell you before the episode's over, after the credits. They do a lot of post credit stuff in this show. I mean, I was kind of surprised by that.
You got to build the drama and the suspense, like make you think and wait for next week. But now we're not going to dick you along for that long.
Well, it's so weird though, because like they show the credits and then like the show goes on for another 5 minutes after the credits. It's just like, why did you do that? It's just weird. I mean, it's just a weird way that they edit the show, I guess. Although this was like a Netflix show or Disney Plus show or something, or
it was Hulu, Disney Plus on Hulu or whatever. But that's not like it was produced like without in Japan. It wasn't like Disney didn't make it like that.
Oh, okay. So it was on television.
Like, yeah. Okay. I think right. It was, but I mean, regardless, there's no indication that Disney had any say in how the show's actually produced. They just licensed it.
I'm just thinking more, not so much that they had a say in it, but that it was like the difference between broadcast and digital streaming, because like it's just strange to have the credit sequence and then another 5 minutes of show after the credits. That's just unusual for television. So I don't know. It strikes me as odd.
It's not common, but it happens often.
It's happening a lot in this show, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, but I think they're just doing it for dramatic effect or to set the mood or whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm just producer and director just wanting to hit a vibe, and so they feel like they can do it that way. But yeah, so let's see. So like we kind of discussed, like this is basically so Masaki's a Quincy. She got bit by that hollow from the last episode, infected with like hollow juices, which is what Aizen was referring to last episode. It was like, ooh, something interesting's happened. I want to see what happens. Yeah. This is what he's referring to, that she basically got hollowified by from that hollow. And then so Kisuke's plan was that he was going to link Isshin's soul, Masaki's soul, and since she had hollow and Quincy energies in her, he needed to have human and Soul Reaper's energy in him to negate her energies and like keep her from becoming a full hollow.
Okay, which before you continue, so just really quickly, why his energy needs to negate her energy? Like right. How? Like by just being close to each other?
He linked their souls. Like, so it's not just physical proximity, but he actually like linked their souls. He did like a ritual to like link their souls together. But for the negating effects to work, he couldn't just be a pure soul reaper. He had to be a soul reaper and a human. Gotcha. She had double energy, and so he needed to negate it with double energy, and he needed the reverse of that. So like Quincy's and hollows are opposites of each other's, and this will become a plot point later on as well. And humans and soul reapers are kind of opposites of each other. And so like this whole mumbo jumbo soul bullshit is how he basically gets it to negate her holification. But then the fact that like she eventually died, and then like her energies, I think, were also like kind of holding his energies in place. So I think that's part of the reason why once she had died, eventually like that soul bond broke and then deteriorated to the point that Ishin could become a Soul Reaper again. I think that's the explanation for why he eventually regained his Soul Reaper powers later on. In
I think they said as much.
I'm trying to explain that as best as I can. I get it. It's kind of like bullshitty, but like, you know, I'm just trying to explain.
It's fine. I mean, I guess I don't want to think too much about this, but like, they didn't have to fall in love for this to work. It was just like their souls were mingled, and that like saved her life. But I think they just romantically fell for each other. Like, that wasn't a requirement.
Falling in love was not necessarily the plan. They just hit it off as two people were compatible and, you know, vibe with each other and boned and whatnot. And so Ichigo is, because Misaki is a hollow Quincy and Ishin is a human Soul Reaper, Ichigo is a Quincy hollow Soul Reaper human. He's four of those things.
He is a
explains a lot about
I'm sorry, I was just joking. He's a mutt.
Oh yes, yes. He is. That explains, like, I think they mentioned this episode, but I can't remember if they do so clear or not, so I'm not sure. But like, Ichigo's, like, the, you know, the white guy who like was always Ichigo's mind palace kind of thing, you know, that he had to fight from time to time.
Yeah,
that's because he inherited his mom's hollow juices or whatever fucking want to call it. So like a lot of what Ichigo has been doing has actually been using kind of hollow powers, not so much Soul Reaper powers. It's kind of weird, and it kind of gets elaborated more a little bit later. But that's also a big deal about why Swordsmith guy was saying like Ichigo's not really a Soul Reaper, and that's why his prototype Soul Reaper sword thing wasn't working, because like the way Ichigo got his powers and the way he uses them doesn't work with that way. And it also explains, of course, why Ichigo's Bankai couldn't be still. It explains a lot of Ichigo's body doesn't really make any sense, but like in terms of different interactions that have been played out throughout the course of the series. But then if you realize, oh, that's because he's fucking everything, it kind of makes sense, even though it's still fucking stupid, but it kind of like pulls it all together in a really dumb way, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And also one thing I'd like to add, I know it's maybe a minor thing, but obviously, after Ryuken takes Misaku's fallen ill from the holification and runs away from the house, like he just meets up Ishin and just staying in the air arguing, and Kisuke is like also just up in air just in arguing with them. I really hate how like at some point Bleach is just like, oh yeah, souls,
yeah,
people's soul powers can just stand in the air, and it really kind
I've said that before.
Yeah,
I don't remember much about when Bleach aired before, but that is definitely one thing I remember and always being frustrated about. It's just that the characters just stand in the air all the time. And it's
I think got introduced in the Waco Mundo arc that started being a thing and they just carried it forward, but just like really messed with, I think, how battles came across, because they're not like flying on the Dragon Ball characters, but they're not on the ground. So all like the choreography kind of gets fucked up. And also I'm sure it allowed Kubo to, you know, skip on drawing the backgrounds, and obviously being a manga is a really hard job, but it was still a detriment of the series, but regardless.
So my thoughts on this episode were basically that it was pretty good. I mean, like it's good. I'm not like blown away by it or anything. I'm not going to try to be negative about it, but I'm just going to say that like, I think I enjoyed them. What I enjoyed most about this episode were the kind of connecting the dots type things about like, oh, this is why this happened and that led to this. And now we know this, and that's good. And I want to know that. And I like seeing that. But overall, was there any particular moment in this episode that blew me away or that I thought was amazing? And I would say, no, not really. I just thought it was okay. There wasn't like anything amazing that happened. And it was all kind of just more about learning the lore. And I like lore stuff, but I just didn't think the episode like blew me away in any way or surprised me in any way. It was all right.
I think it's totally fair sentiment. Yeah.
Like I don't want to come across sounding like I didn't like the episode. I liked it. I just didn't think it was just amazing or anything. I just thought it was like, yeah, okay, that's good.
I mean, it had to live in the shadow of the Andaline episode we just watched, so that really wasn't helpful.
Yeah, and I like learning about the weirdness of this world And they did a lot of that in this episode. So there's a lot, although some of it, I will admit, having just talked to you about it, like some of it is confusing, but it is, it feels like Kubo at least had plans, or maybe not plans, but he has answers for how things work. So,
yeah, like I don't know if he necessarily planned this out from the beginning, but I'm sure like as he was kind of moving things along, he thought like, oh, maybe this will have how I kind of fit things together. And it, like, it's stupid, but it does work. So like kudos to him for that.
Yeah. I kind of felt that way too. I felt like it's like, yeah, maybe he didn't have this planned all out along, but he came up with an answer that fits. So that's, you know, that's all right.
Yeah, that's more you can say for Lost series. Like Lost series that where they have answers that are stupid and also don't make any sense. It is stupid, but it works. So yeah. That's props to him. But.
Okay, let's talk about the season finale of Blue Exorcist. Blue Exorcist Episode 12, Candid and Open. All right, quick rundown. Tatsuma returns home to his angry wife, and she is not happy to see him, but he is alive. He does survive this story. Meanwhile, Mamushi wakes up, and she is opens the door and finds Juzo standing there, and she cries because she obviously felt really bad about everything that happened. Rin and Shemi also meet up. He wakes up kind of in like a recovery room with a bunch of other people, but I guess Shemi wasn't recovering. She was just laying there because she fell asleep. They have a nice little meet cute moment. And you get this moment where it's kind of like, oh, is Shemi going to profess how much she really loves Rin? No, she just says they're going to be friends forever. So I wrote down friend zoned. Someone in the group watch posted Blue Balls Exorcist, which made me laugh quite a lot, actually.
It's supremely good.
It's great. But yeah, I mean, that's just, Shimmy just can't admit it. You know, it's pretty obvious she really likes him. However, we get this much more interesting scene right after that, where it's Shura and Mephisto, and it starts out really strange because Shura starts like coming on to Mephisto and she's like getting all up in his business and being like, oh, and being very sultry and seductive. And I'm like, whoa, what the hell is this? But it's all sort of a ruse. She's got Mephisto kind of pinned down on the ground. And then she sort of like is about to attack him. And she's like, I know that you've got some kind of plan for Rin. You're up to something shady. I've got my eyes on you. So she was just kind of seducing him into like, you know, to kind of get close to him. But then just so that she could get a jab in here about the fact that she's on to him. He's up to no good. And she knows it. And he's letting her know that. I kind of forgotten that Mephisto had hired Shura or got Shura to do all this work, that she was working for him. I kind of forgot that. But yeah, she's on to him. But it was a kind of a fun scene. And it was weird to hear Mephisto, too, being like, ooh, he's into it. It's not a sight of Mephisto I've ever seen before.
Yeah, first time he kind of expressed anything like,
any kind of romantic feelings or anything. Yeah, it's just not.
It wasn't like romance. It was more horniness. Like,
oh yeah, well, okay, yes, true. Yeah, I'm sorry, I was the wrong term. Yeah, he was hot for her in that moment, which was unusual. But I guess he is, you know, he's a demon. Whatever. Pretty interesting scene, and I like how Shura came across in that scene because she was like a badass. Come back from the commercial break and we get like this whiplash of a scene where suddenly Juzo is telling everyone that he and Mamushi are getting married. And Mamushi is like, what? I didn't agree to this. And everyone's like freaking out about it. I don't know if that's like her two younger sisters or something. And they're like,
yeah,
they're like,
those are younger sisters.
Okay. That makes sense. And they're like, oh no, you shouldn't go with that Juzo guy. He's a loser. And then likewise, Juzo's brother is like, oh, you're going to marry a weird snake woman? This is weird.
Yeah, I think he wasn't even like, well, I thought you were going to marry some hot, you know, big titty booty babe or something. I think he like, those words like actual words that he's upset he wasn't marrying a babe or something. Like marrying a snake stick or something. He's like, what the hell, man?
That was weird. I could kind of understand the younger like siblings, like that kind of trope makes sense to me. But him being like, oh, you're going to marry this weird snake. She's not that, I mean, she's not unattractive. What's your problem, dude? Like, chill out. Anyway,
well, he was always kind of like the horn dog, wasn't he? That's always the vibe.
He's I guess, kind of off. Like it's like he's just not up to her his standards, I guess, or something.
He only dates nines and tens. He would not be bothered by 8.95.
Well, the big thing that comes out of this is that she's like kind of like shocked by this whole thing, but then she kind of just agrees reluctantly that she's going to go ahead and marry him. And the parents are there and they give their blessing, and it's all just very awkward. I'm okay with it for what it is, because I think it's just sort of like, I don't know. I'm sure there are people out there who are like, this is wrong. But I'm like, I don't know, whatever.
I can't be bothered to care, honestly. I don't have enough strong feelings about these characters to care one way or the other.
I mean, I'm sure there's like angry people out there, pitchforks, who are like, these arranged marriage shit is bullshit, and she should have a say. I mean, I think she has a say, but I think she just falls for him in that moment.
Maybe I was misreading the situation, but wasn't it implied that they like fucked the night before, or did I overread that?
Oh, I did not get that. If you, I mean, maybe on a rewatch, I would pick up on that. I did not get that. I thought they just had fallen for each other romantically.
I think that's they have all. A prior relationship. I think this is them like locking.
Oh, really?
Down. I think so.
Oh, like, I'm if not that's sure the case.
Keep it going. But my sentiment is that they had something relationship, and they may or may not have sex last night. But I could be overreading that. I'm not sure. But I think they had a relationship of some sort beforehand. They're not just like random strangers who don't know each other.
Just for complete transparency, no, I did not pick up on that at all. I did not think they had a relationship. I think this is a situation where two people had went through a traumatic experience and they just decided to go for it. That's the impression I got, which is what made it so strange, because it just feels like it was his idea and she wasn't in on it. But anyway, she relents anyway. So that's that scene. As Seda and I discussed last week, pretty much what we expected to happen happens now next, which is they decide to end the episode on a much lighter note. Everyone goes on a tourist trip all around Kyoto. And they go and they see all the different sites and stuff. And everyone's pretty much getting along now for the most part. I mean, Izumo is still being Izumo, but like everyone else is kind of like chummy now, and they're not been out of shape about the fact that Rin is the son of Satan anymore. They're all cool about it.
They're teasing him about it constantly. Like even the group photo just spying on Satan, I think in was it like in kanji or something, or was it in English? I don't know.
I couldn't tell, but yeah. It looks like they were making S-A-A-T, you know, it kind of looked like English letters to me, but I wasn't sure. But anyway. There is, however, after all the fun and games, the episode kind of ends on a much more serious note when Rin and Yukio, because at the beginning of the episode, Rin is like, hey, Yukio, when we have a moment, I have to have a talk with you. And so now we end the episode with this scene where they're kind of like at the riverside or whatever. And I don't know. It's just basically, I can't really do it justice. I'll just say what I wrote down here, which is Yukio still doesn't approve of Rin being an exorcist. So it's like Yukio and Rin are still button heads. He doesn't want Rin to be an exorcist, but Rin's going to do it anyway. And Rin says, you know, I need you, Yukio. And there's a lot of conflict and uncertainty amongst Yukio in that scene. That's pretty much it.
I took that as a manifestation of both Yukio being mixed feelings about his brother. It's kind of like he obviously loves his brother, but also kind of resents him as well, and kind of for some unnatural reasons, something that's kind of explored a little bit in his fight with the boss from earlier in the season. And obviously this fact that like Yukio's starting to express demon powers himself, he's a little worried about that. And he's just, I think Yukio is kind of like uncertain about his place in the world and what's going to come up next for him and what he's supposed to do. And of course, that's kind of, he's not so much taking out on Rin, but like his uncertainties and worries are kind of definitely manifesting in how he interacts with Rin. And also, you can still joke around with each other a bit, but, you know, Yukio is both worried about his brother, concerned for his brother, resents his brother as far as becoming like his brother, is like wondering what his father was left for him to do. Like, Riku is kind of going through it in his head a little bit in ways I think, given his circumstances, are pretty understandable and relatable, you know?
Yeah.
So like, that's obviously mixing things up. But Rin is obviously expressing a lot more confidence. He's got his mojo back. You know, aside from getting completely friend-zoned, things are pretty much looking all Rin now, I would like to say. He's feeling good about himself. He just beat up the demon, Impure King. So Rin's in a confident place, and he's a good place. But obviously, he still looks up to his brother. He still loves his brother. So, like, there's that kind of tension of each of these characters kind of their own headspace, going in different directions. They still love each other, but they still kind of, like, are angry at each other, kind of, like... I think it's a good brotherly relationship that kind of has tensions in a way that makes sense for brothers to have. And they're, of course, both going through their own shit, and that's kind of manifesting how they're interacting with each other. But I think in ways that generally make sense. So I think it's contentious, but it's working, I think, in terms of at least from a writing perspective, I feel.
Yeah, I thought this was a pretty decent episode. I mean, I like it. Actually, I liked it a lot. I thought this was a pretty fun episode. It's definitely the kind of relief that we needed after all of the serious stuff that happened. The characters bouncing off each other was fun. The comedy was pretty fun. Overall, I thought it was pretty good. I mean, I mean, I'll be interested to hear what Seda says when he comes back about the ultimate state of Mamushi, because
he was wanting her to get redeemed so badly.
Yeah. I kind of feel like they kind of did it here. They didn't really 100% give her a full redemption, but I felt like there was more of her in this than I expected. So I thought they did enough to kind of like paint her as being remorseful and stuff. So I don't know. I mean, it is weird though that it's just kind of a joke at the end with her. So I don't know. It was fine.
I would say they did stress some things, like in terms of whole, like when Juzo was asking for her hand in marriage from her father, basically her father's like, are you sure you want her? Like, she's about to be exiled for what she did.
Yeah.
I was going to be fucked up forever. Like, there's kind of real serious consequences for what she did. And Juzo's like, yeah, I don't care about a shit. She's my gal. I'm all in. Like, so that was kind of nice and sweet and tender, yes. But also kind of like emphasize that there are lasting consequences for what she did, which is not redemption, but like that is consequences. You know, you're an adult, yes. You did a thing, and then you got adult consequences followed through from that.
I like that. Yeah, that was. I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah, the fact that they pointed out the fact that she is going to get in trouble for what happened. That she's not off the hook. It's not like a everyone lives happily ever after moment. I like that a lot. Again, that kind of helps give that character closure, even if it's not ideal. I mean, she obviously is accepting her fate, so that's good. I will say real briefly here, and then this is not a. I mean, whatever. The whole comment about like, do you want my daughter, even though she has like a busted eye? That bothered me. I'm like, come on, get like what? Like, she's not fucking ugly. I mean, I hate that.
I mean, honestly, it's not a good thing for a father to be saying, but I feel like I can imagine a lot of fathers saying that, especially in that kind of traditionalist mindset. So yeah. I'm not saying I approve, but like, it didn't surprise me to hear something like that come from him, given the context of what was going on.
As silly as this whole idea of like, she's just getting pushed into a marriage here and then goes along with it. As big as a deal people made that didn't bother me as much as her own father's comment about her being ugly. And I was just like, dude, fuck you.
She's like, well, at least he wasn't like the other guy. Like, I don't know, my daughter only has 8 cups. Are you sure you're into that? Like, that would have been like way across.
It felt like that, though. It felt like that to me. It felt like, oh, well, she's damaged goods. I'm like, fuck you, dude. I don't know. That bothered me. Okay. Anyway, but overall, the episode was nice. And I am really interested to see where they go next with this whole, especially not just with the story, but with this whole, like, different studio making the show. We'll see what the tone and the quality of the animation looks like next week.
So one thing I really liked, kind of how at the beginning of this arc, where a lot of characters, Bond especially, but even a lot, and it also Izzy, or you know, I forget his name, but I say Izzy because he's the same voice actor as Izzy from Digimon. So
that's what Seda does too.
Okay, fair enough. But like Izzy and Bond especially, were very kind of trepidatious around Rin. They were like really spooked about the whole Sun Saving shit. And then by the end of this arc, after everything they've been through, now they're joking like, ah, me and my friend, the Son of Satan, we go, you know, paddling around and whatnot. So I think that turnaround was pretty, it was funny, but it's also like earned. I felt like over what happened over the course of the season, it made sense. Like the turnaround makes sense. Like basically Rin got his friends back and he like earned it. And I think that, I think just the way they executed it across the scene was pretty strong. And so how that arc kind of played out, I thought was very good. I like to see that, how that came to play. Like, because in the filler, when they're doing filler shit in the first season, it was kind of just like turn of the hat kind of stuff. And but then they were mad at him and then they hated him again and they liked me. It was kind of, you could tell it was filler because the way it was written didn't really make any sense. But here, this is just like they had a plan. The characters interacted with each other, their relationship developed over the course of her arc, and went from one place to another in a way that made total sense and felt totally earned by everyone involved. And I really liked that, how they kind of got really their, they became real friends by the end of it, and for, I think, what was good and earned reasons. So I think that was very good to see. That was well executed by the show, I felt. I'd also mention another thing that, going back to Shura, like, I think this is the first time they revealed in this episode that she's descended from the line of Kunoichi. Did they mention before that she was like a ninja?
Maybe. They might have, actually. I can't remember with certainty, but I kind of felt like when she said that, I knew that already.
Okay. So maybe I hadn't been paying attention earlier or something, but like that obviously explains a lot about kind of her disposition and what she was doing there, because obviously Shinobi and Kunoichi, male and female ninjas, obviously exist in real life. They weren't flipping and dipping and throwing fireballs. That's all fake bullshit. Like, Kunoichi in real life were known for being like seductresses and like kind of spies and kind of like sleeping around to get information and seduce people and whatnot. Like, that's a real thing that happened. And so like that being Shura's kind of thing, and that's like the reason she was like flopping her tits in Mephisto's face, that's like, that's a very sure thing to do, and it's also a very Kunoichi thing to do.
Yeah, it is.
So
yeah.
I know. So obviously the show's, you know, it's fan service, and obviously the show's getting some chance. Like when it gets,
I don't have a problem. By the way, I don't have a problem with Shura fan service. I'm perfectly fine with that.
No. Like I think, like I know there, like some people in the thread had mentioned they kind of ignored how it's executed here because I guess they put more emphasis on her breasts and her butt and whatnot in the anime than in the manga. I think Graham posted the manga panels, and like that's fair. Was shown off in the manga, they did put more emphasis there. But here, I thought it made total sense. It was completely in character for Shura, as opposed to remember the scene back when Rin was confronting Bond and it was about his father.
I remember that scene very well.
Yeah, like you know, your Shura's taste was flopping all over the place, like. That made no sense. That was pure fan service.
That was the animators just kind of going off. They're like, no, they're not, like, they should have reined it in a little there.
Right. Whereas even here, even if it did embellish, like, it made sense for who Shura is and what she was doing. So even if you added more boob shots, that made, like, that was a fine, if maybe even good addition, as opposed to back then where it was just like, I don't know, animators were just like horny one day or something and just needed to chill or something. That there was a pretty big contrast there. So honestly, everyone noticed in this episode, but here I felt it worked and it makes sense for who she is, especially if she's playing the role of Kunoichi, which is what they did in real life. So yeah, I noticed it, but I thought it was fine as opposed to that previous episode where it was just like, I like titties as much as the next heterosexual guy, but like there was a place and time and that wasn't it back then.
Yeah. Yeah, overall, pretty good episode, like I said, and I liked it. I thought the season was better than I expected. So
I think Bluxus is trending in a good direction. I've heard people say that future seasons are even better, so that's encouraging. Actually,
I agree because my feeling on Blue Exorcist has always kind of been like, oh, it's just sort of like generic anime, and but no, it's actually pretty entertaining, more so than I thought. So I'm kind of into it.
One last thing I'll say is that I thought the bit where when Shiomi friend zoned Rin, how like more people kept showing up. Like they're all in the room at the time, but Rin only kept noticing more people as they kept commenting. Like the pink haired guy, like, oh, I feel for you, bro. And then like Izumi was in the other curtain being like, shut up, you love bros. And like everyone was getting a commentary. And I thought it was pretty hilarious. Everyone was just dunking, taking turns dunking on Rin. Shin was like clueless to all this, but Ring was being his dragged through the mud. It was hilarious.
Yeah. Last thing I'll say is just about the upcoming season is that like this obviously was very Bond focused season. I get the feeling that the next season might be Izumo focused, and if so, I'm all for that.
Oh yeah, that was a pretty big part of their preview. I heard people say that the puppet guy is also supposed to become important at some point eventually.
Oh yeah, he's like a big enigma, and they even mentioned it in this episode. I think Shura was like, because Mephisto handpicked all these students, so it's like they're all part of his plan, is what she says. And then she's like, well, why this puppet guy? Like, what's his thing? And so we don't know yet. So, yeah, interesting. Okay, let's move on to the final episode of this block, which is One Piece. One Piece episode 740. Fujitora takes action. The complete siege of the Straw Hats, which does not happen in this episode.
I mean, Toei for you.
Yeah, Toei episode titles, not true. All right. So Suru and Sengoku finally arrive at Dressrosa. And by the way, I put in a special note here because we were talking about, like, what is Sengoku doing now? Well, he's no longer Fleet Admiral. He is now the Inspector General of the Navy. So that's why he's still working. It's not a demotion, quote unquote. He's just changed positions.
I mean, it's a demotion, but like Inspector General, yeah. Their job is real corruption in the whatever organization you're working for.
I guess what I mean is that technically it's a downgrade for his position, but I think he took that, like he wanted that. So anyway, yeah, they're there and they're here to, you know, of course, to get on Fujitora's case about what happened. And while they're there talking to Fujitora, the Tontatas arrive and yeah, they kind of meet them and, you know, Suru and all of her female crew are all like smitten by the Tontatas and Mancheri and everything. Gyatso gives another stupid speech. I didn't even write down what he said. I didn't care. And then Rebecca is back at the palace and she's getting this dress put on her because now she is going to be the new princess of the kingdom. And while this is happening, there's this rumor that's been going around that they figured out who Rebecca's father is. It was this prince, this long true prince who died. And there's all these different rumors like, oh, I heard he died at sea, or oh, he died in this battle, or whatever. And there's this rumor going around, which comes back at the end of the episode. After the commercial break, Mancheri is making those little flower things to heal everybody. And so she's still doing that. Back at the cabin, everyone's eating. Luffy is sleep eating. There's a lot of Luffy, like half awake, half asleep stuff here. And then Kiros reveals that he's actually the one who started the rumor about Rebecca's father being some prince, because he does not want Rebecca to be associated with him because, of course, he was a criminal. And while it sucks and Luffy agrees that it's a stupid thing, I kind of get where Kiros is coming from. He wants Rebecca to be a princess, and the stupid laws of the nation and the world say that she can't be a princess unless her father is a prince. So that's why he's hiding it from everyone. And then the final scene of the episode is Fujitora gives Suru another dice roll. He says, I don't know if he said it was like 3 days in a row. For 3 days in a row, he's rolled the dice, and every time he got, you know, it was like fish, two singles or whatever, which means that the Straw Hats get off that day. Then they're going to get attacked. But this time he's like, Suru, okay, you go ahead and roll it this time. And they roll it. And sure enough, it's not this time. It's a different number, which means they are going to attack. So the Navy are now going to go after the Straw Hats in law. And that's the episode. So what are your thoughts?
I think the main thing that stood out to me is that I feel like Kiros just refuses to get over himself. Like, yes, he was a criminal. He did some fucked up things as a youth. He probably murdered some fools. Like, sure. He has long since redeemed himself. He helped save the kingdom. Yeah. He was obviously a better man than he was in the past. Like he's not that person anymore. So the fact he keeps beating himself over that is, at this point, I think gone past being relatable to kind of being obnoxious. Like, it's obviously hard, easy to say to do, oh, just get over yourself. Like, you can't just really say that to someone in real life and just start to work necessarily. But, you know, my reaction feels like to tell heroes, dude, you put in your penance, you're putting your work, you did your contrition, get over it. You got the girl, you earned it, you saved the kingdom, you earned the prize. Like, in your daughter's life, just exiting her life, you missed basically 10 years of her life. No need to miss another 10 years or whatever just because you feel guilty for shit you did 20, 30 years ago that you've long since redeemed yourself for. Like, if you killed some people in cold blood, I guess there's no real way to, like...
Well, he could... serve his time. Why doesn't he just serve his time? And then, like, that, you know, I mean, they could, like, lock him up for, like, for 10 years or something. You know what I mean? Like... I don't know. It feels like there's a better solution here.
Right. Like, if he really wanted, he could do the jail time. But in all honesty, the king would probably, like, dude, you killed, like, 5 people in cold blood. That's fucked up. But you can save, like, 5 million people's lives now.
Okay. But yeah, I agree. I agree that the king would probably do that. But I'd say, like, then someone should tell the king, no, Kyros needs to feel like he served. He needs to feel like he was punished. You know what I mean? Like... for him to get over it, because it's all in his head, right? He's the one who's making a deal about it.
Like, exercising himself out of his daughter's life is not punishing himself, it's punishing Rebecca. And, like,
exactly, I agree with you completely. And I also feel like a part of this is also, I think, more this sort of like weird classism rulism that goes on in the One Piece world where, you know, it's like, oh, you can't be a princess in this situation. Like, I can almost see a situation where, like, if the people found out that Kyros, this murderer, like, if they found out Kyros was a murderer, even after everything he'd done, they would be like, well, you're no new true prince. She can't be the princess. Like, to you and me, that would be the stupidest thing ever for these. But these are, like, stupid One Piece people.
It is true. One Piece citizens are amongst the dumbest citizens of all anime, manga, fiction, so on and so forth. Like, granted, you'd think, like, I remember how much shit they're giving Luffy even in the middle of his fight of Doflamingo. Like, that may have been the toy editions. I'm not sure if that's true to the manga or not, but they were giving a lot of shit during that fight while they were trying to save their asses. But after Luffy actually went ahead and saved their asses, if they were still giving people shit, like, that would be like, all right, that's, you should just all, like, stop breathing because you're taking up the rest of the oxygen, the rest of the need.
But it's also, it's that, and it's also this idea that, like, oh, well, she can't be the new princess if her father isn't a prince. It's just a stupid rule, right? Like, the people want her to be the princess, but then they might also be like, well, we can't do it. That's not what the rules say. And it's like, get over it. Like, that's the kind of dumb shit.
I've not seen Dressrosa. I only know what I know about One Piece at this point from cultural osmosis. So I don't know if maybe, like, next episode, because obviously Luffy's pissed about this. So I don't know if maybe next episode Luffy knocks some sense of Kyros and resolves this plot point. I have no idea. But as for right now, I think it's just stupid and Kyros to get over himself.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, like I said, it's just a post-Dressrosa episode. They're all kind of like whatever. I mean, there's good ones mixed in here from time to time. I thought the last episode was pretty fun with the Kaido stuff, but like, this is just sort of like, yeah.
What episodes of this we have? That's still a bunch.
Of Dressrosa?
Yeah.
Hang on. I'll tell you. I was looking this up. 1 second. I think we're like, I want to say at least 5, but maybe more.
And then I think I heard someone say it a filler arc and then starts Zao, right?
Oh, I don't know if there was a filler. I don't remember that.
No, that's what I heard. I could be wrong, you know, Samba.
Oh, it does look like there could be potentially a little fillery episode or two here. Yeah. Yes, this looks fillery. I don't remember this. This must be part of why I thought it was longer than I thought, because I don't remember this filler stuff. Okay, yeah. So 751 is when the next arc begins. So, yeah, we're looking at about another 10 episodes.
Jesus.
But again, I think Dressrosa is, like, not all of that. Like, there's probably about 5 or 6 of those episodes that are some non-Dressrosa stuff.
But they probably suck, right? So that's the
probably thing, because I have no memory of them. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about flavor alerts.
Flavor alert.
Potential award nominations.
Like you said, yes, let's nominate the Okarun and Momo fight versus Turbo Granny, right?
Yeah, that's definitely going to be highlight of the year.
Yeah, that was a good one. Yeah.
I missed the last few flavor alerts. What I know, I think Seda wanted to add Momo, obviously, but also her voice actress. I think that was the last flavor nomination I heard about you guys adding. What else have you added since then?
I'm looking here. We added Stephanie Nadoli as the voice of Goku in Daima.
That's fair.
We added Toto as a best villain.
Air.
We added the Goku versus Tamagami 3 fight.
Air.
We added Seiko as a character design.
Air.
And let's see. That's about it, really.
This scene, pure King here as aka Blob Monster. That's, he didn't really do much. This is Blob around. That's fair.
That was like a, yeah, he's like worse something.
I'll definitely put, I think Okarun is, I mean, he'll obviously have more good moments. Like, we haven't seen the best Okarun yet. But I definitely feel like he's a, I put in best male character.
Or you we're waiting. Satan and I decided that we're going to wait a little longer on Don to Don. I mean, I think all three of the main characters we've been introduced are fantastic, and they're probably going to get nominated. But we're just going to wait a little bit longer because it's only August. So
fair enough. I assume Momo was on here already, so that's why. But I
just she's not. No, that's the thing. She's not a best character yet. Just her voice. Just her voice
actor. Okay, fair enough. All right.
Anything this week, though? It's really the question. Anything else? Nothing's jumping out to me. I'm looking through it.
I mean, maybe Ring getting friend zoned. That's kind of funny.
That's not really a category, though. It's like a best moment, you mean?
I think so.
Yeah, I don't know.
Fair enough. I
mean, it was humorous, but
what about the field trip? Kind of showing how they've kind of grown as a team.
I don't. I guess it's not best to me. It's just like good. Like, it didn't blow me away. I'm going to stand by this. I keep saying this, but next year, we're not going to have a best moment category. I think we're going to have best episode category. And then we can nominate episodes that blow us away. Like, I wish we had that this year, because I would nominate this Don to Don episode as a best episode of the year for me. Because the problem is, there's a lot of good moments in that episode, but I don't want to pick any of them because it's not like one moment in that episode is better than any other to me. It's all just great.
Are there episodes we've come across recently where you felt there was no best moment, but the episode overall was the best episode? Because yeah, I assume you want that category, because if something came to mind that's like, oh, this would be perfect for this, but doesn't.
Yeah, it's more about the fact that we constantly have this issue where we want to nominate, like we want to come up with a moment, but then we talk about it and it's like, well, no, it was like half the episode. And it's like, well, then we should just nominate the episode. You know what I mean? We should have that instead of trying to be like, well, what's a moment? What constitutes a moment? I don't know. I just don't like that category.
Okay. Would worst moments then become worst episodes, or would that?
No, I think worst moments are worst moments, because that works. That's usually a single thing that a character does that makes us like, or an episode does that makes us really like, it's offensive. Like I could almost see somebody wanting to put like Mamushi being forced to get married is a worst moment, but I'm not going to go there.
Okay, fair enough.
Again, I think that was more like cultural differences / joke. We're going to have I think when we get closer to the end of the year, we'll have a lot more like best male, best female characters to put in here. We're just kind of holding off on those, I think.
Okay, that's understandable. I think we cover everything then. Like, I mean, we always talked about Kirios being a dummy, but I don't think that's a worst moment. That's just him being stupid. But.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't say he's a worst character either, because he's actually a pretty cool character. He's making some dumb decisions.
No. Yeah, of course. Yeah. I think Kirios, like the probably thing besides his continual self-flagellation, probably the only thing that really bothers me about Kirios is his physics don't make any sense. Like, how does he do all the shit on one leg? That's like,
yeah, we talked about that last episode. Said and I were bringing that up about, because there were like, there was a scene last episode where they animated him walking like a normal person walking, and it was like, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, just nothing about that part of his character design. I get why he has that, because if he had to break through sea stones, he'd cut his own leg. Ooh, dramatic, whatnot. But I think it's just too torture. Give him a peg leg or like a fake leg or automail, anything, whatever. I don't care. Just put something there.
Automail. All right. Well, we'll end it there then. We only got one thing this week, but we've been putting a lot in here over the last few weeks. So it's good stuff.
Walk's in a good place generally. So.
Yeah, that helps. You're right. Good shows. It's actually pretty entertaining right now. Okay. Well, that'll do it for this episode. That's episode 437. We will be back next week. It's not really premiere, but I guess I'll say it. It's like the premiere of the next season of Blue Exorcist. I mean, we are literally just going directly into it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because they showed the promo and everything. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll just go around into it.
So, yeah, that'll be an interesting... I'm really curious to see how the show will be different next week. So, all right. Well, thank you for being here, Crocodile.
My pleasure.
All right. And until next time, later.